This is The Arc of Change with Donzo Leggett, a podcast from the Anti-Racism Commitment Coalition, an organization dedicated to eradicating racism and hate and spreading anti-racism. Listen as Donzo talks about the relevant topics that will inspire you and help build your capability to take action and change the world. Because none of us are doing enough as long as racism still exists. And now, here's your host, Donzo Leggett.
Hello and welcome to the first episode of Season 5 of The Arc of Change with Donzo Leggett. In this episode, I welcome longtime ARC member Jeremiah Cox to share his incredible near-death experience and to discuss how relying on hope, that's H-O-P-E, or how optimistic people endure, not only fueled him to survive his harrowing ordeal, but to stay positive and continue fighting for a more righteous world. Now let's get started with our show. Welcome to Season 5 of The Arc of Change. I'm Donzo Leggett, your host and founder of the Anti-Racism Commitment Coalition, or ARC. Our vision at ARC is to build a racism-free world, and our mission is to provide inspiration, education, and support for you to transform, practice, and spread anti-racism. Now, this begins with our three-step process for personally transforming to anti-racism. The first step is erasing your ignorance. Step two is educating yourself. And the third step is building the character and confidence to stand up, speak out, and take action to spread anti-racism and anti-hate and make positive change happen. Now, I want to start Season 5 by first and foremost thanking you, our listeners, because you have inspired us to produce 35 fantastic episodes in the first four seasons. And because of your dedication to our show, we've almost reached 5,000 all-time downloads and counting. So once again, thank you, thank you, thank you, and keep listening, because in Season 5, we will bring even more positive energy, great topics, and of course, inspiring guests. And this episode is a perfect continuation of that. Because in today's world, more than ever, we need positive stories of overcoming daunting circumstances to persevere and continue to strive to take action and make positive difference happen. It can be exhausting to continually stand up and speak out and take action when it feels like little to no progress is being made. But we have to stay optimistic and keep going. We call this hope. That's H-O-P-E, how optimistic people endure. And on the Arc of Change, we see it as our duty to bring on incredible guests to profile and exemplify what hope, H-O-P-E, is all about. To keep you inspired, to show you what not giving in or giving up, even when the situation appears lost, is all about. What having the courage to be the light when the environment around you is most dark is all about. Showing how optimistic people endure when most everyone else would relent, fold up their tent, and go home. We need these stories of hope. And on this episode, we have an amazing one. Jeremiah Cox is an incredible young man, one of ARC's charter members and lead volunteers. Jeremiah embodies the ARC mission of standing up, speaking out, and taking action to spread anti-racism and anti-hate. He spreads positivity everywhere he goes, and he believes in making a positive difference. Jeremiah is how optimistic people endure. But what happens when someone as positive as Jeremiah faces one of the most traumatic events that anyone could experience or could imagine? An event that almost claimed his life. How did this affect his hope? Well, we're going to find out, because Jeremiah is sitting right across from me and he's here to share his amazing story. Jeremiah, welcome to the Ark of Change.
Thank you, Donzel. Thank you for such an intro. Holy cow.
I know you're going to live up to it because your story is incredible. Now, obviously, I know you. I've known you for a long time. But why don't you just make sure everyone else gets to know a little bit more about you?
Yeah, for sure. So I've been with Ark since, you know, shortly after George Floyd was murdered when we were still putting it all together. I grew up most of my life in Chaska, Minnesota, so a suburb of Minneapolis, and went to university at the U of M, University of Minnesota in Minneapolis, Twin Cities. And now I have branched out and launched a financial services business within the last year, and I'm living in Eden Prairie, Minnesota, and loving it and just kind of enjoying, you know, starting out in life and enjoying being a dog dad and exploring the world. So I've got a lot of things that are tied up with who I am, but I guess that's a high level overview. And eager to kind of share this story with you today.
That's awesome. And Jeremiah, I remember the first time I got to see you, you were performing in a play or something like that my daughter was playing music in. And I was like, wow, that kid's got a lot of bravery. He's up there dancing like all by himself, which I thought was really cool. But when I really got to know you, you asked to interview me for an op-ed that you were writing. Why don't you tell everyone about that, why you decided to do that, what that was all about?
Yeah, for sure. So this was, again, right as the time that ARC was kind of being thought of, created as a concept, really, when George Floyd had just recently been murdered. And I was just finishing high school. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm kind of embarrassed to admit this, but I didn't even realize that, because at the time when George Floyd was murdered and protests started, you know, gaining a lot of popularity around Minneapolis and around the world, I was preparing for the National Speech and Debate Tournament. So I was head down, focused on my speech. I didn't even realize what was happening 20 minutes down the road until I was in a coaching session with one of my coaches. And he asked me how it was in Minneapolis.
Wow.
which is kind of embarrassing to admit. But once my eyes were open and I realized what was happening, I felt like I had to do something. And we were both living in Chaska at the time, which is super, super red, very conservative in many ways. And there was very little outrage and buy-in into what had happened at that point. And so I felt like I needed to kind of force people's eyes open a bit. Yes. So that's what I was seeking to do with the tools that I had available to me. I was at that time wanting to go into journalism. And so I was writing to the Chaska Herald and local papers. And finally they agreed to let me write an op-ed. And I was like, okay, I have to share a perspective that's different than just my own. Cause I'm, you know, a cishet white dude, 18-year-old who's going to listen to me. So I reached out to you, and you were gracious enough to offer an interview, and we were able to reach the community. We got some nasty responses to that letter, but you know, it at least got people's eyes on an issue that they may not have given much attention to otherwise.
That's right. You know what? And what I really appreciated was, you know, so you said, hey, I don't know a lot, but mm-hmm. I want to learn mm-hmm. and I want to hear from someone who has firsthand perspective. But you didn't stop there. So you wrote that. You said there was some pushback. Other people may have, you know, went hid or said, hey, I'm going to college. I don't have to worry about this. But then you formally joined ARC and you've done some incredible things since you've been with us. I mean, you helped start the Deep Dive talk show, produce it. You're a co-host on the show. Mm-hmm. You started and ran our Instagram account, which was awesome. You ideated and said, hey, I think there's a way we can get interns. Mm-hmm. You created our intern program from scratch. We now have over 30 interns and counting, and we're just getting incredible work done. Yeah. What drove you to then say, I'm going to get involved, I'm going to stay involved, and I'm going to do what I can to make a difference with ARC? You know, why did you do that? Why do you keep doing it?
Great question. I feel like it's a combination of, you know, I was raised that way, so I can thank my parents for a lot of that. But also I feel a tremendous amount of gratitude and also just obligation to give back to the world and to deconstruct the systems of oppression and power that have disproportionately afforded me advantages. I feel like, yes, I've been given a lot of privilege, but I also, with that privilege, have a great responsibility to deconstruct it so that it won't exist and, you know, create unjust systems or continue to perpetuate them for future generations. So that's kind of what drives me. It comes somewhat from a place of guilt, to be completely honest, but it's also just a place of like, I've been given a tremendous amount of privilege, and I have such an incredible gift that I can have, you know, impact with that. So why not use it?
Yeah. And that's what I see. You know, around you is just positivity and wanting to help others. Mm-hmm. And it may be, like you said, maybe there's some guilt there, but I don't ever see that. What I see is someone who just wants to do good things and help people. And so I'm gonna start kind of fast forwarding us to story you want to talk about, and just kind of give you a little bit of my perspective. So I talk about how Jeremiah created this intern program. He started from scratch, created the process of recruiting interns through LinkedIn. But then last summer, he informed me that he had to go on this this trip to Africa. And I'll let him tell a little bit about it. But at that point, I had to then take over the intern program. And so I'm working with Jeremiah distance-wise. You know, we're having Zoom calls, and he's sending me information and screenshots over WhatsApp to coach me through how to do all this. And all of this is going on through this whole process where I've got questions. I hired the interns, but even through the process of summer, I still had questions. And Jeremiah just continued to respond, his same cheerful self. I never knew the story he's going to tell you until October. He's already back. This is already months later. And his dad mentioned, hey, did Jeremiah ever mention to you what happened to him? Just to give you an idea of how positive this guy is and how he never lets little things keep him down when it comes to making a positive difference. So I was floored when his dad told me what had happened to him. I could not believe that he never even gave me a hint that something was going on. So Jeremiah, I'm going to let you kind of tell your story. I know you and your dad have a history of going to Africa, but last year you went. Tell us a little bit of kind of what led up to that. What were you there for? And then get into the story. So I'm going to turn it over to you.
For sure. Yeah, thank you. So growing up, my family, we were fortunate enough to live actually in Madagascar. My dad worked there. He was working with the local health systems around the country to build up grassroots healthcare infrastructure, and had some very impactful work there. We returned home to the U.S., which for me became my home because I spent ages 0 to 6 in Madagascar. We returned to the U.S. in 2008 and stayed here ever since. And so I have always had a huge affinity for the country, the flora, the fauna, the people, the culture of Madagascar. And so now that I finally finished college last December 23, I said, okay, I'm going to go back. I'm going to, like, I don't know what I'm going to do for a career yet. I was still figuring that out. But I have some time. I'm going to go travel. So I found, actually, my dad found an internship that was available at a really remote eco lodge in a remote region of Madagascar. The only way to get there was by a boat or like a 3-day hike through the mountains. And I sent them an email. They copped on a Zoom with me. They offered me a 2-month internship. And I was thrilled. I was like, okay, great. This is how I'm going to go back and visit home, basically.
Yeah.
And so I did that, and I flew there, set up all the arrangements and whatnot. Once I got to the country, it was incredible. I mean, I was spending 2 months in the rainforest, completely off the grid, pretty much. Well, it was completely off the grid. All that we had for power was solar and diesel generators.
Wow.
And that was when they worked. So it was an incredible, incredible place, incredible experience. If you ever have the chance to visit Madagascar, I highly recommend it. I mean, the wildlife was pristine. It was one of the most, like, intact forests in the world. It's one of the last places in Madagascar that hasn't been touched by deforestation or, you know, all sorts of climate-related changes. Yes. So it was just beautiful. Wildlife everywhere. Insects, bugs, birds, fish, lemurs. Cool. It was incredible. I would get woken up many mornings by some really raucous white-fronted brown lemurs who would just make a cacophony. They sound like pigs that are flying through the air. It's really, it's really funky, but it was such a cool place. And then the story that we're getting to here is it was on the ocean. So this is the place where the ocean meets the sea. That's the name of the forest in Malagasy. That's the translation of what it means.
Okay.
And so, you know, you had hiking activities in the forest, but you also had ocean activities. And one of the ocean activities is kayaking, right?
Yeah.
Because it's within a bay. It's usually fairly calm seas. And so the owner of this lodge was teaching me to kayak on these fairly sophisticated surf ski kayaks. I don't know if you know anything about kayaking, but it's a very, very narrow kayak that's intended for going really fast and surfing down waves. So it's extremely unstable and extremely technical. And at least for me, it was really hard to figure it out. But he was teaching me how to use these so that we could go faster and further and do some kayaking trips, which would be fun. And so one day, randomly he invited me to join him on these surf ski kayaks. And I was like, great, let's do it.
Yeah.
Hop on the kayak. Little did I know, I grabbed one that had a crack in the seat. And so, I was thinking about, well, if I had been thinking, I would have been, oh, this isn't a problem. I'm just going to, you know, be out here for a couple hours and then back, and any water that gets into it will just be drained out. But, as you'll see, it was a little more than a few hours.
Okay.
So anyways, we get into the ocean. He goes ahead. He's already given me the kayak lessons. So I think he's thinking, okay, we'll just do our own thing. He takes off. He's trying to get as much kayaking in as he can, for the day before the sun sets.
He assumed you were fully trained at this point. He had no idea about the crack either.
I think he thought I took one that didn't have a crack.
Okay.
Because there were three, and we were using two of them, and I mistakenly took the one that had the crack.
Okay.
So there was some miscommunication involved, and I thought we were going together. I think he thought we were just going at the same time, but independently.
Independently.
So one way or another, he ends up way ahead of me because he's a really good kayaker.
Yes.
I'm left behind just kind of, okay, trotting along, trying to figure it out.
Yeah.
And then there are some waves that come, and, you know, the swells start to get bigger and bigger. And I notice the local fishermen who are in their lakana, their dugout canoes, where they use hand lines.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's very, very rudimentary technology.
Yes.
Where they literally just hollow out a tree.
Yes.
And float in it. They're making a beeline for the shore.
They're turning back.
Yeah. And
so they're like, this is a problem.
Exactly. And I should have probably, noticed that and taken that as a note of warning.
Yes.
But
what did you think when you thought, oh, they're just going back? Did you think, you know, maybe I should go back?
Or I didn't.
Or did it just not register?
It just didn't register.
Okay.
I was thinking, because they always have a routine and a pattern where they put their lines out every night, then they come back in the morning and pull them back in.
So you just thought maybe they were heading in a little early.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Yeah. I was not thinking.
Yeah.
And then lo and behold, As I'm getting to a crest in the
horizon, kind of the ocean.
Yeah. So like there's like a point, and after that point, the sea kind of calms down a bit. But at that point, that's where it's most exposed to the wind.
Yeah.
And so getting through that point and around it is the trickiest part.
The key. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And there are also some fairly large boulders in, like, about 20 meters out from the shore that you have to dodge.
Okay.
So you have to be kind of cognizant of where you are and make sure that as the swells are coming up and down, you don't end up on top of one of the boulders.
Yes.
So I was trying to get past that point. I was paddling as hard as I could. Then the waves start coming in and they get pretty high and pretty fast. Then I get thrown out of the boat a few times but it's a surf ski kayak. So it's intended to be, you know, really tippy
and
it's pretty easy to get back into.
Okay.
But then the waves kept getting stronger and stronger, and then I couldn't get back in and stay in.
Okay.
I could get back in, I could get my feet into the boat and I could start paddling, but then as soon as I brought my feet in and started paddling, I would tip over again.
Oh, man.
And so I kept repeating that dance of, you know, flipping it over, put stomach on, butt in the seat, feet in, start paddling. Yes. Kept doing that over and over again, probably 20, 30 times before I got tired. Then I would rest and hang onto the kayak while I'm just kind of floating next to it. Then I tried again for another 20, 30 times.
And all this time, the guy that invited you out, still nowhere to be seen, nowhere to be found. He's gone.
Yeah, he's gone way past me by this point.
Okay.
And he's going to come back on his way to get to the camp.
Yeah.
So in my mind, I'm thinking, okay, well, whatever. Like, this is embarrassing, but he'll see me on his way back.
Yeah, you don't feel like your life's in jeopardy.
Right.
Yet. No.
Right. Okay. Yeah. And like, I'm kind of kicking myself for going out in this, what I didn't realize was going to be a storm, but there's no real threat yet.
Right.
And so I kind of, eventually I'm like, okay, whatever. I'll just float along and I'll wait for him.
Yeah.
I'll keep an eye out. And when he passes, I'll say, hey, can you tow me?
Yes.
And he'll pull me back to camp. And then it starts to get dark. And I'm thinking, huh, this is weird. Where is he? I mean, he's a pretty gung-ho kayaker, but he wouldn't go in the dark because that's like an unnecessary risk. And then it gets completely pitch black.
Oh, my gosh.
And
you're stuck in the ocean.
I am. I'm floating next to this kayak that I can't even get into.
Oh,
and the waves are going up and down and up and down. And what I later discovered is he had returned to camp. And because of the sound of the storm and the size of the swells, he just couldn't see me. And so he probably went right past me. I don't know how close, but I wasn't too far off from shore. So we probably just passed just so barely.
Wow.
And he made it back to camp. And then when he got there, realized I wasn't there and went into search mode.
Yeah.
But lo and behold, I'm still here wondering where he is. And it gets completely pitch black. I mean, for like almost instantly once the sun sets, I can't even see my face or my hand in front of my face. And I'm like, oh crap.
Oh,
like, this is not good. And so I start yelling, I start like screaming. I can see the camp lights on shore.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, okay, they've got to be able to hear me, right?
Yeah.
But it's a storm, there's wind, there are waves, they can't hear anything. After about 5-10 minutes of yelling and screaming, I discovered that there's a whistle on my life jacket.
Okay. All right. Good.
So I start blowing on that. Feel a little bit silly that my voice is hoarse from yelling by that point. But
yeah. Like Titanic, you said, let me blow this whistle.
Exactly. Yes. And then after I start blowing on the whistle for a few minutes, the moon comes out.
Okay.
And it's awesome. I can see again.
You can see. Yeah.
It's almost a full moon. It's probably like a 90% full moon.
Yeah.
And I'm like, okay, I'm going to be okay. I can at least see where I am and someone's going to find me because there's visibility. Right. And so I keep whistling.
And by the way, was this area of the ocean where sharks or any danger of sharks in this area?
I mean,
or you're not so much worried about,
I wasn't worried about it. Of course there are sharks there.
Okay.
But I'm
no crocs either.
No, fortunately.
So crocs not
no.
On mainland Africa, but not on Madagascar.
Okay. Well, there are in Madagascar, but not in the ocean.
Not that far out in the ocean.
Yeah.
Okay.
Like in rivers inland there are, but
okay.
not in this region either,
okay.
Fortunately. So I wasn't really worried about predators. Of course, I guess I could have been eaten by a shark, but I wasn't really very tempting. I didn't have any open wounds.
So this time you're still positive Jeremiah.
Yes.
Still
exactly.
Like everything's positive. The
exactly.
Sun is coming up. I'm good.
Yep. Yep. I mean, it's a warm sea. There's very little risk of hypothermia.
You're the only guy in this situation that's like probably smiling and thinking it's going to be okay. I'm like, hey, I'm warm. I'm good.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's a little bit weird. And that's how kind of I was keeping myself positive throughout this thing. Cause I knew like it was kind of instinctual. I told myself, hey, if you panic, you're dead.
Yeah.
Like that's it. You're done. You're going to drown. You're going to exert your energy and you're just going to be dead.
Yes.
So I didn't even make that an option.
Yes.
I said to myself, okay, I've got to stay engaged. I've got to stay awake. I've got to preserve my energy. So I started making jokes to myself. Like, wow, this is such a good cardio workout. And like, this is the full body exercise that I needed. And I started seeing these little bioluminescent plankton in the ocean.
Yes.
Very, very low frequency of them. So it wasn't like, you know, the images you see where like a whole wave is bright blue, but little sparks here and there of blue light, which was cool. I'd seen them on the southern tip of Madagascar when I was younger, and I didn't realize that they were in this region. So that was fun. I was like playing with them, splashing the water.
Oh my God.
And just making sure that I was still engaged, awake, and positive, because that's the only way to survive that.
Yes.
And eventually, like I said earlier, the owner of the camp, he, when he got back, he was starting to look for me. So he sent out search parties. They sent out three different boats to go up the coast in both directions and then straight out into the bay to check for me. And so I started seeing searchlights.
Yeah.
And I saw a searchlight, you know, of course I'm at sea level, so yes, I'm bobbing up and down above and below the waves. And so I see this light bobbing and I can see it every few seconds. It's coming towards me. And I'm like, yes, finally. So I'm blowing on the whistle as hard as I can. And then I'm like, yes, I'm going to get picked up and I'm going to be able to make it back to shore safely. And then it makes a big circle around me and goes down the coast the other direction.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. And then it comes back and it comes.
And you're blowing the whistle?
Yep.
Wow.
Yep. But keep in mind, we're in the middle of a storm.
So it's very loud.
Yep.
Very chaotic.
Yeah. Raining, wind blowing, waves crashing. There's like, I was probably within 25, 30 meters of them.
Wow.
And they couldn't hear or see me at all.
Wow.
Yeah. And so it was almost futile to be blowing on the whistle.
Okay.
If I'd had a light or like a beacon,
yes,
it may have worked.
Yes.
But I didn't have those.
Yeah.
So yeah, they make a big circle around me. They go down the coast the other way. They come back and they make another circle around me the other direction. And then they go back to camp.
Oh my
They just
God.
Can't see me.
Wow.
And they have to give up the search because it is dark. It's dangerous to be going maneuvering in the dark at that point, because they
especially
could,
with these boulders you said were in
exactly,
this area as well.
Exactly. Yeah, they could easily ground themselves or damage their boats. So they call it a night and they start sending people up the coast, like local Malagasy people with flashlights to search for bodies that wash up along the coast.
So at that point they kind of thinking you're
they were very unsure.
Oh
and
my gosh.
Like, yeah. They were worried, understandably, because there are a lot of people who die at sea.
Yes.
So they start looking that way as well.
So this is a bad, the storm is awful. They go out looking for you. They can't find you. They basically give up the search.
For the night. Yeah.
And then they have people looking the search line in case your body washes up.
Right.
That's in its pitch. The moon is out, but it's still in the middle of the night.
Yep.
You're stuck in the ocean and they give up the search.
Yep. Yep.
Man.
Yeah. I mean, it was, there wasn't much that they could do.
Yeah.
Because there was no visibility. There's no, like, there's nothing else that they have access to.
Right.
No helicopters or anything. So they put out a call on the local radio station that is listened to by everyone in that bay. That says, you know, watch out for a white dude in a white kayak. And if you see him, let us know. and so everyone, all the local people were looking, but there really wasn't anything they could do until the storm cleared up. So I'm just floating around, you know.
So what's your mindset when you see the light from the boat head back to shore? And at some point you realize they gave up the search.
Yeah, it was scary, and it was kind of a blow to my hope at that point, thinking, wow, like, there go my chances for the night. And I realized, okay, well, I'm going to spend the night at sea. I had no idea if I was going to make it to shore or if I was just going to float until someone found me when the storm passed. But I knew that that's what was going to happen. I was going to sleep at sea, and that was that. I couldn't do much about it.
Yes.
So yeah, instead of wasting energy being upset about it or trying to change the situation, I just kind of tried to make the best of it.
Yes.
And that's all we can do, just control what we can control, right?
Yes.
And so,
so you still maintained hope.
Yeah.
You just knew that for the hope to come to fruition, there's things you had to do.
Yes.
to stay in control, to not panic, and to recognize, hey, I got to make the best of the situation because I'm stuck here now, out in the ocean, at least till the storm passes, and I just got to survive.
Exactly, exactly. And so what that looked like in that situation was simply staying warm, staying awake, and not panicking.
Yeah.
And so I was, you know, I've done some meditation work throughout my life, so I was focusing on my breath. I was staying very aware of how tired my body was. I was hyper aware of how tired I was because I was being mindful. And I was wanting to stay warm. I know it was a fairly warm sea, but hypothermia is always a possibility because, you know, water dissipates heat 25 times faster than air.
That's right.
And so I was taking turns on and off swimming versus resting and just kind of like holding myself and containing body warmth as much as possible. And I was, by that point, I had been drifting quite a ways. I started out maybe 2 kilometers south of camp, and eventually I drifted several kilometers. I have the number here in my notes, but by this point, I'd already drifted probably 5-7 Ks
Jeez.
North. And so it was very obvious to me that I was in a current and which direction I was headed. And it's very fortunate in retrospect that I was caught in this current, because remember earlier how I said there was that point that I was trying to make it across. If I had gone past that point and got caught in the opposite current, I would have been pulled straight out into the Indian Ocean and probably died. Like very, very higher probability of dying that direction. So because I didn't make it past the point, that may be the reason why I'm still alive. Because the current that I was stuck in was going north,
yes,
towards the mainland.
Yes.
And so I saw the direction I was going. I knew that direction because I knew that the local village was in that direction, and I knew that there were coral reefs that I could access and swim to and stand on top of and call for help because there were people that lived on the coastline. So I tried to swim to it. And I was swimming as hard as I possibly could, as long as I possibly could before the muscle cramps and the fatigue took over, but I just couldn't get anywhere because the current was way stronger than me.
Yes.
Like even if I had had fins and webs on my hands, like it would have been a challenge. And so I basically said, okay, I'm going to let this current take me where it's going to take me and I'll figure it out when I get there. Yeah, exactly.
And were you still holding onto the kayak, or you'd let the kayak go?
By this point I had let it go.
Okay.
So yeah, by the time I had passed the camp and it had gotten dark, I realized that it was just it was weighing me down because there was the crack in the seat. So it was taking on water, and the more I clung to it and the more I held it as my raft, the more water it took on. And then it just, it got to the point where it was just so barely under the surface, like hovering, like not even above water.
Yeah.
I was like, this is not helping me. This is using more energy than it's like providing benefit.
Yeah.
It's
counterintuitive to most of us. It sounds like you're a great swimmer, but most people would think you want to hold on to anything that's going to give you buoyancy if you're not in water where your feet can touch the ground, because you've got to use energy to stay above water.
Yeah.
But your thing was, this is actually causing me to expend more energy than if I just let it go.
Right.
And let myself drift.
Right. And I was spending more time underwater when I was holding the kayak.
Really?
Than when I just let go. Because it was kind of awkward holding a kayak, and then the wave comes and you're like, you roll with the kayak. So you're under the water for like 3/4 of the wave. Whereas just floating by yourself, like you're able to.
You can ride the wave.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
So yeah, it is a bit counterintuitive. You're right.
Yeah.
I never thought about it like that. So eventually I was, after I had ditched the kayak, I float for a few Ks upstream or up current. And I try, I can't swim to shore. So then I give up and I kind of just float along and see where the current will take me. I see in the distance that there is a kind of an outcropping of rock and land that comes out and juts into the ocean a little bit.
Peninsula, like a small peninsula.
Yeah. Like a very small peninsula, probably like 1/4 of a kilometer. and I see that I'm headed in that direction, and I'm like, okay, well, I'll just wait till I get there and then I'll swim to shore.
Yes.
And then it'll be it.
Yeah.
And then by the time I get there, I notice that it's not going to be that simple, because I see this peninsula, and coming out from the peninsula, this is at the base of a small mountain.
Yeah.
And so there are two rivers that are coming out and entering the ocean at that point.
Oh gosh.
So the water's cold now.
Yeah.
And there are three different currents pushing me in different directions.
Yes.
So my goal is to cut in between the middle of these two rivers, because they're probably about maybe like half a kilometer apart.
Yeah.
And so if I can get in between them, then I can cut between those currents and like get into the middle and get to shore that way. Problem is, they're both pushing into the ocean really hard.
Yes.
And so there's a cross current from the actual ocean, and then the two river currents. And I swim every single direction that I could possibly identify, and I just can't make any progress. Yeah. At this point, I'm basically just trapped in one spot. And then now the water's cold, so there is risk of hypothermia.
Oh my God.
And so I'm like, uh-oh.
And so now positive Jeremiah is starting to worry.
Yes, a little bit.
Okay.
And at this point, I'm not even really thinking at this point, because I'm tired and cold and just like now I'm having to swim to stay warm.
Yeah, just to stay warm.
And it's like I have to swim more than I can rest. Yeah. And it's really exhausting because I'm already tired at this point.
Yes. You've been in the water now for how long?
Probably like 5-6 hours.
5 or 6 hours.
Yeah. And so I just kind of give up at that point. Not as in like, okay, I'm going to die. Fine. That's okay. But as in like, I have no control over the situation. Mm-hmm. I'm going to let whatever happens happen. And I'm just going to conserve energy.
So you're going to try to float.
Exactly.
Try to continue to breathe, but you're not trying to get to shore. You're just saying, okay, wherever the current takes me, it takes me.
Yep.
And hopefully by the time light comes, they can find me.
Yeah.
And I'm still around.
Exactly.
So you're not like, I'm going to die, but you're like trying to get to this peninsula is not going to happen.
Yep.
That's kind of what you're saying.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. So I literally just, you know, make my body as small as it possibly can to conserve warmth. And I wrap my legs around themselves so that as much skin contact as possible. And I just close my eyes for 15, 20 minutes and float and bob along. And also, mind you, by this point, I didn't have a very good life jacket. I did have a life jacket, which is very fortunate.
Yes.
But it was a very old one that had been sat on many times. If you know anything about life jacket foam, the more it's condensed, the less effective it is.
Yes.
And so it was taking on a lot of water, and the longer I was in the water, the less buoyant it became.
Yes. Yes.
So it wasn't ideal, and I was basically just buoyant enough to kind of tip my head back and have my head above water by this point.
Yeah.
And I was grateful that it was raining off and on throughout this. So I was able to have some fresh water from the rain.
Okay. I was going to think drink. The opposite. I think that would expedite hypothermia, but you're saying it was actually a good thing.
It was.
Because the ocean water is keeping you warm.
Yeah.
And the fresh rain was giving you some water to drink.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it wasn't like a torrential downpour.
Yeah.
So it was just enough to have a little bit of hydration.
Yes. Yes.
And so after those 15, 20 minutes of kind of resting and not sure what was going to happen, I opened my eyes again and I looked, and I was somehow right at the intersection of those two river currents.
Really?
So right where I was trying to swim before.
Yes.
That I couldn't get to when I was paddling as hard as I could. I had somehow gotten there.
Yes.
And I was like, okay, this is it. So I was probably like 75 meters away from shore. And I don't know why I'm talking in meters, because we're in the,
well, you were in Madagascar.
Yeah.
That's probably the
that's probably how it is. But, I told myself, okay, this is my last shot. If I don't get to shore right now, I'm going to end up getting pulled past this peninsula and get deeper and deeper into the bay and rolling the dice on what happens at that point.
Okay.
So I start swimming as hard as I can. My muscles are cramping. My body's kind of screaming at me because it's out of juice at that point. And eventually that 75 meters becomes 50, and that 50 becomes 20. And then eventually I touch something with my feet and I stand up and my feet are getting cut apart by barnacles on this rock, but it's the best feeling in the world.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And so I get to this rock. It's a few meters away from shore. And I'm just kind of like in shock still standing there. First time touching solid ground in several hours. And I, you know, splash my way to shore and find a rock to sit on. And holy cow, I just take a minute to kind of process all that. But then it's not over at that point, unfortunately, because over. I've made it to shore.
Yes.
I'm on a rock, but I'm on a beach technically, but it's a big boulder beach with a really heavy surf.
Oh my gosh.
And so I had no concept of time at this point. I thought it had been like maybe an hour or two. I didn't realize how long it had actually been that I was in the ocean. So I was like, okay, I'll just walk back to shore. It'll probably be a couple kilometers. It turned out I had drifted 12 kilometers.
12 kilometers?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. We're talking just under 6 miles or something like that?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know what the conversion is. Something like that.
A little over 6 miles, I'm guessing.
Yeah.
I think a 10K is about 6 point something miles. So we're probably talking around like 7 or 8 miles.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah. Whatever. Wow. Yeah, I know. It was much further than I had thought it was going to be. And I very quickly realized once I started walking up the coast, I didn't have any energy left to walk that entire distance that night. And it was unsafe to do so because there was a really strong surf. And so I had to dodge the waves and I could only walk every few seconds when there wasn't a wave that was crashing.
Right. Again, this wasn't a sandy beach like a Jamaica or something.
Not at all.
We're talking boulders and
exactly.
rocks.
And dark.
Dark. You know, dark.
Like boulders, slip your ankle and everything.
And waves crashing.
Exactly.
And you're trying to walk this.
Yep.
And you've got several miles to walk.
Yes. Yes. So after a little bit of walking, I'm like, okay, this is not going to work. I have to stay here for the night and wait until it gets light enough so I can actually see where I'm walking.
Yes.
And so that's what I do. I actually find a small little cave.
Cave?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
And so I find a stick and I poke around in the cave and I'm like, okay, there are probably no scorpions or things in here. So I set my life jacket down and I lay down against a rock and just kind of cross my fingers that it'll all work out. And then about 30 minutes later, the tide comes in and starts filling up the cave with cold seawater. And so I'm like, oh crap. So I leave the cave, I grab my life jacket and my stick, I use it as a trekking pole to kind of hike up into the mountain a little bit. I find a spot that's behind a small rock, so it's at least a little bit protected from the wind, and I set my life jacket down, lay down on it, and I kind of nestle up and try and sleep. And then it's cold and raining, so I find some large leaves and I cover myself in mud. Then I cover myself in leaves on top of that to protect. The mud is for like a blanket, and the leaves are for the water protection. And then I spend the night kind of off and on, awake and shivering when it's raining, and actually able to sleep a little bit when it's not raining, probably because I was just so exhausted.
Oh, yeah.
And that's how I spend that night. And then I wake up, shivering and cold to the bone.
Oh my God.
And fortunately, again, the seawater is warm. So I go and I sit down in the seawater and warm myself up. And then I start walking back to camp. I walk probably a kilometer or two. And I am able to find a couple streams as I go and I take a few sips of water. I didn't realize this, but these are fresh mountain streams that are completely free of human.
Pristine.
Yeah. So like I could have drank all of it and filled myself up, but I was worried that I would get Giardia or something.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I didn't want to add that on. Turns out also that night that I slept there, I was illegally camping in the national park.
Oh.
So that was an accidental crime.
Yeah.
And so I walk back. After a couple kilometers, I'm still blowing on my whistle at that point because I figure they're going to be sending out more search parties. And then eventually I hear, no, actually, eventually I get to a house It's an old research station that university researchers from around the world will stay at when they're researching, you know, all sorts of the unique parts of the ecosystem in Madagascar. And I go inside, I'm calling, you know, Misulu, any people here? No one. And I'm also kicking myself like, wow, if I had just walked a little bit further last night, I could have had a roof.
Right.
And so anyways, I keep walking. And then I hear someone call out and I look into the ocean and I see there are two local guys from the camp who are on a kayak who have been sent out to look for me.
Oh, wow.
And it's like, wow, here we are. I'm saved. Everything's good. Backtrack to where they are. They get me to a stream and they have me cross over it. I had actually crossed over that stream on my own when I was walking back towards camp.
Yeah.
Turns out that's a very dangerous stream. Apparently it was a pretty strong current. I just kind of stumbled my way across it, but, it was entirely possible that I could have gotten
swept back into sea.
Yeah. Wow.
You were very fortunate.
Very, very. Yeah. And anyways, they came on a two-person kayak. One guy hopped out and jogged back to camp, because they were still well rested. Yeah.
Unlike you.
Yes.
They hadn't spent
the
entire night in the ocean and fighting rocks and shivering and swimming and exhausted. And so they had a little bit more energy. They could try it.
Exactly. Yeah. And so the other guy, he paddled me back, and he's a strong local fisherman paddler guy. And I was eager to get back home. So I was paddling as hard as I could.
Yeah.
And he was like, slow down, please.
So you had the energy. You were like, I got to get back.
Yes. That was, I guess, my last little bit of adrenaline. And eventually we got home. Everyone was kind of a little bit in shock, including myself. It took me a while to realize what had happened. But I went and I ate a big meal. I drank a whole bunch of water. I went and slept for like 14 hours.
Yes.
And then, yeah, that was that story. The conclusion to the story is, everyone in that entire region now knows that there's this white guy who got lost in a kayak and came back, and they treated me like Harry Potter, the boy who lived. Literally, I mean, I would be eating breakfast and there would be 30, 40 villagers who would come by and just stare at me. Like, no words. They were just like in awe.
Yeah.
It was almost
because they knew that what had happened, there's no way you should have survived that.
Right.
That's why those local guys, you saw them coming in.
Exactly.
When they saw that storm.
Exactly.
So from their standpoint, you know, it's like, this is impossible that this guy actually survived.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
How did you call your parents right away? When was the first time you called and told your parents what happened?
I didn't tell them until about 3 months afterwards when I had gotten back to the US.
Wow. So you didn't come, you stayed.
You stayed,
finished your internship.
Yep.
And like what did you, I mean, you just like forgot about it?
Well, I didn't want to scare them because knowing my parents, they're the type of people who would be worried and afraid and would hop on a plane and come to Madagascar. And that felt unnecessary and I didn't want to put them through that.
Yes.
I did call my brother and tell him because I felt like I had to talk to someone.
Yes. Yeah.
But he'd agreed not to tell my parents until I'd gotten back to the US and I was able to tell them all together. And so that's what we did. I had a whole like pictures and everything presentation for them. They were quite shocked. But yeah, I stayed there and completed the internship and we were the lodge owner and I, he suggested it and I thought it was a great idea. We bought a cow for the local people they butchered it and spread it amongst themselves. Every family got, I think it was like 3 kilos of beef.
Wow.
And I mean, in this region of the world, the like beef consumption is like reserved for once a year, maybe. And it's like a huge event. Everyone was like ecstatic, like
celebrating the white guy. Yeah. Right. The Harry Potter. Of
exactly. Exactly. Yeah. And later when I went back to like the main port city where where the radio station was, where they announced that this guy was missing. It was so bizarre. Everyone and their mother was coming up and shaking my hand and really? Like saying, "Hey, praise God, we're so grateful you're here." And wow. Somehow everyone knew who I was. It very, very small town feel.
Yes.
Local, very remote area. It was a little bit bizarre, but that's how it happened.
So near-death experience that very few of us have these. I mean, I would say this is one. Mm-hmm. Clearly, the reaction of the local people tells you that they did not expect for you to survive.
Yeah.
How did that change you, if at all?
Yeah, great question. I think the biggest thing that it helped me to realize is there's not much point in waiting to do things. We have, you know, life is so fragile. We have a very limited time on this earth, and we never know when it's going to end. Why wait? If you want to do something, just do it. And yes. And so it really broke down my inhibitions and my it shattered my kind of risk avoidance a lot. And so in the months since then, I've started a business. I've skated a marathon. I've run a marathon. I'm planning a trip to all sorts of places in the world now. Like why not? Like,
yes.
it's broken down a lot of things and. It's not to say that I'm exceptional. It's just that I realized I can do that. I want to do that. Let's do it. Like, yes. For instance, the marathon, I decided I wanted to do it 4 weeks before the marathon was going to start. No training whatsoever. Wow. I was just like, and I'm not a runner either.
Right. That's awesome.
And I didn't have a good time, but I got through it.
Yes.
And it hurt my body a lot, but it was really fun.
Yes.
And now I can say that I've run a marathon, right?
Yes.
So like, that's been the biggest change, is like realizing that there's no point in deliberating and worrying what other people will think. And of course, the further I get from that night in the sea, the harder it is to cling to that, yeah. Because the world comes in and tells me that I should be a certain way and that I should do certain things and live, you know, a certain way. And it's hard to cling to that, but it's always good to remind myself of how fragile this is, that our life is, and how much we need to take advantage of it.
Yes. You know, what's interesting, I started off by talking about how positive you are and how you seem like you always want to make a difference mm-hmm. for people. But when you talked about what changed for you is you mentioned things you're doing kind of for yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, the things you're, you know, risks you're taking, things you may not have ever done before. But I still notice you're still doing these other things that you were doing before. Mm-hmm. Like still, even though you got this business you're starting and you're super busy, still putting a lot of time in with us, with the Anti-Racism Commitment Coalition, trying to volunteer, trying to make a difference with people. Even the business you chose mm-hmm. is a business that in a way tries to give back to people.
Absolutely.
So has this experience kind of reinstilled your hope around not only not being, you know, hesitant around taking risks, but also about, I want to continue to be positive and help people.
Great question. I think it has, in the sense that, again, there's no point in waiting. I think a lot of activism, especially in the US right now, is stalled by a sense of hopelessness and like the feeling of, okay, well, what can we even do? You know, we've got XYZ fill in the blank in office. Yes. We're powerless for the next several years. But at the same time, if you don't do that, if you don't do something, like how's that going to make you feel?
Yes.
It's almost like I had the perspective, and I was gifted with the perspective of being on my deathbed.
Yes.
And when I'm 85 years old, that's typically how most people approach it. Like when you're 85 and you're on your deathbed, will this matter? If it doesn't, don't do it. And if it does, run towards it.
Yes.
And the work that ARC is doing to change people's hearts and minds and create a world that is free from anti-racism, or excuse me, free from racism, full of anti-racism. Yeah. That, I mean, that's powerful and that means something. And who am I to stand in the way of that, I guess?
It's such a powerful message right now. You said it. That was going to be like a question I was going to ask you. What advice would you give people mm-hmm. today who feel powerless in this environment? Because but I hope that as they listen to your story, there were so many opportunities where you could have quit.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people would have. But you continue to maintain hope and stay positive. You continue to give yourself positive messages.
Mm-hmm.
You know, something went bad. You quickly figured out, okay, well, what about this?
Mm-hmm.
Another thing went bad. What about that? When all hope seemed lost, the two streams, you're stuck. All right. You could have said, I'll just sink to the bottom and just be done with it. Mm-hmm. No, you said, you know what? Let me preserve all my energy, all my heat, and let me float until something better happens.
Mm.
You never gave up. And what I hope people hear from this today is never give up and take your shot. Because when you woke up and you looked around, you said, here's my shot.
Yep.
You took it.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I just think that's awesome. And I just want to, if there's any other last message that you want to give to people that listen to this and that are just not sure what to do or feel, again, powerless, defeated, what difference can I make? I'm only one little person. What message would you have for them?
You're not alone, and start small. Everyone is feeling the same way. We all feel this hopelessness, this dread, powerlessness. And the beauty of that is that we can share in that feeling together. You don't have to be an island. But at the same time, you don't have to do everything. You don't have to be attending every single protest. You don't have to be running for office or like doing some big thing, whatever that big thing looks like for you. Maybe it's, you know, starting a conversation with someone. You don't even have to go that far. Start small. Like if you have, I mean, a conversation is typically my example of what is small. So now I just kind of cut myself short, but you know, maybe it's posting something on social media. Maybe it's writing a letter to a congressperson. Maybe it's starting a conversation with a family member who has had some challenging beliefs and trying to help them kind of see a different perspective. And that's what ARC is all about. We are intentionally focused on education and changing people's minds first, because that's where change stems from. And so it doesn't take moving a mountain, right? All it takes is one little step. And then if everyone does that, and if everyone continues to take a little step consistently, that's how we'll actually see some real change. So take your step.
That's awesome, Jeremiah. I started this off again by saying how you bring positivity to everything you do. And in my view, when I think about how optimistic people endure, you are that personification.
Thank you.
Even before that story that you told, which, by the way, audience, it's the first time I've heard that story in detail. I heard a little bit, but I'd never heard the story in detail from beginning to end. And it sounds like I heard it, at least I heard it not too long after his parents heard it, which, you know, it's kind of interesting. But you are the personification of how optimistic people endure. And this episode, I really hope a lot of people listen and really take heart that it's not like you're a superhero.
Right.
You know, you're not, you don't have a cape on. You're not flying around the world. You're not rescuing, you know, kitties and trees. You're an everyday guy trying to make it. Got an apartment, trying to live, but you're also trying to do things, little things, every day to make things better, just like you said. So Jeremiah, like I said, is also the co-producer and co-host of the ARC Deep Dive. Please, you can find the Deep Dive on our website at www.joinarcc.com or .org.
.org.
And you guys have a show that's going to be coming out, is it this week?
Next week.
Then what's the date?
The 16th, I believe, Wednesday.
Wednesday, April 16th. So please check out the Deep Dive. And if for some reason you listen to this podcast after that episode is aired, all the Deep Dives are recorded.
Yep.
And you can find them again on our website, www.joinarcc.org. Jeremiah, thanks again. You're awesome.
Thank you.
I really appreciate it. Keep inspiring us with your hope.
Thank you.
The ARC of Change podcast is brought to you by the Anti-Racism Commitment Coalition. Visit us at joinarcc.org to learn more about ARC and join our movement.
To find the ARC of Change podcast with Donzel Leggett,
And to learn more about the Anti-Racism Commitment Coalition, or ARC, and to register for the ARC Personal Transformation Experience, please visit us at joinarcc.org. You can also subscribe to the ARC of Change on your favorite podcast hosting sites. I greatly look forward to our next episode and another opportunity to inspire you to become part of the movement that will change the world by ending racism once and for all. Until next time, stay inspired by continuing to ask yourself, am I doing more about ARC? And always remember that none of us are doing enough as long as racism and hate still exist. Thanks for listening, and goodbye.
Change Podcast with Donzel Leggett is brought to you by the Anti-Racism Commitment Coalition. To learn more about ARC, donate to our cause, and join the coalition, visit joinarcc.org. Don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode, and share this podcast to help spread our mission to change the world by ending racism once and for all. Thanks for listening. Until next time, stay safe and be inspired.